This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll hear about the shifting balance between utility companies and the solar panel customers in Wisconsin.
First, we're taking a look at two new court decisions affecting Wisconsin. On Friday, a federal judge struck down the state's law requiring that doctors who perform abortions have admitting privileges at local hospitals. That law has been on hold for a couple of years now.
And this morning, the U.S. Supreme Court decided not to take up Wisconsin's voter ID appeal, meaning that the Seventh Circuit's ruling that the law can stand is the law of the land in Wisconsin.
Joining us now is WPR's criminal justice reporter, Gilman Halstead. Gilman, good to have you back.
Nice to be here.
Well, as we've been hearing in the news, the Supreme Court decision. Now, we heard from the U.S. Supreme Court that they're not taking up this voter ID law. Did they give any indication of why they're not taking it up?
No. And they generally don't when they are saying they're not taking something up. They're just saying they're not certifying it. And that means what we've been hearing in the news, that the Seventh Circuit ruling that was in place is now the law.
So this non-action is the deciding action in a way. This was the last, at least for now, the last appeal for opponents of the state's voter ID law.
Right. For Wisconsin's, that's true. There are still a couple of others out there that are making their ways making their way through the federal courts in Texas and North Carolina, which have similar laws. I believe they're both in place in those states at this point. Actually, North Carolina was set to go in next year, 2016, but challenges are wending their way through the courts, so the Supreme Court could get another shot at it.
Now, in the run-up to our fall midterm elections, pretty big election here in Wisconsin, governor, some other things, there was like a real stop-and-go thing going on, and the U.S. Supreme Court ultimately put the law on hold. What was their argument for taking that action then? It was more procedural than weighing in on the constitutionality of the law. Is that right?
Exactly, right. It was procedural because of the difficulties of when to impose it and how practical it was to actually get everything in place, even though the laws was passed back in 2011 and preparations had been made and then pulled back and then made again as the uncertainty of the law actually going into effect continued. Mm-hmm. So and that leads up to the decision that's been made right now, which is that even though it's now the law of Wisconsin, it will not be enforced during the April 7th election. Because it's impractical, mainly because absentee ballots have already been mailed out and people are actually voting absentee in person right now. And so it would just be a total chaos to try to say, well, now you have to take this back and go get a picture.
But then, now we've been watching this thing for a long time. So this election, Supreme Court to Justice in Wisconsin, a couple other things
right.
on the ballot. No ID required there, but from then on,
yep.
unless something weird happens and there's a change that we don't expect, this is a done deal now.
Exactly. In fact, Kevin Kennedy, the elections board, said that they're already getting the word out to folks in a couple of municipalities about some, or counties, where school board elections, special ones, are scheduled in May, and it will be imposed then. And then the next statewide election where it would be imposed would be a primary in February. We could have another Supreme Court primary, actually, in February. It's not clear yet whether that will be an open seat or whether there'll be more than two candidates. That's for Justice Crooks's seat.
Now, just briefly on response from supporters and opponents, what have we heard from the governor and the attorney general on this one so far?
Well, we did just hear in state news that the governor is very happy about it. He says that it will make our elections have more integrity and make it harder to cheat. And a similar statement was made by the assembly speaker, Robin Voss, who was one of the big backers of this bill. From the other side, the ACLU still believes that it does impose discrimination on the elderly and on low-income minority voters who may have difficulty in getting a photo ID. But the Seventh Circuit said not enough difficulties.
We're talking to WPR reporter Gilman Halstead about court decisions in Wisconsin. Now, we just heard about voter ID. Let's turn to this ruling now last Friday on abortion. Gil, federal judge William Conley struck down Wisconsin's law requiring admitting privileges for doctors who perform abortions here in the state. Law passed in 2013, as I understand
right.
it. So what's been the path to this point, the legal path?
Well, it's bounced down to the Seventh Circuit once in terms of Conley had put a temporary injunction on it, and that was challenged. And the Seventh Circuit said at that point that they felt it was legitimate to have it stayed until Conley made a final decision and really on the merits. And that's what he did on Friday. And his ruling said that these admitting privileges at local hospitals have no basis in medicine and would impose an undue burden on women's health outcomes due to the restricted access to abortions in Wisconsin it would create. Could have led to the closure of at least one clinic. And that's where it stands right now. There are several of these laws out there in other states that are facing different kinds of challenges. And what we should say first, that the Attorney General's office here has not commented on the ruling except to say that they're reviewing it and are preparing an appeal. So it probably will go to the Seventh Circuit once that appeal is filed. So there's seven states now that require abortion facilities to have an agreement with a local hospital in order to transfer patients if there is a complication, and including some other states that have requirements on clinicians who work in those abortion clinics. There are a total of 21 states that require abortion providers to have some sort of formal relationship with a hospital. We don't right now because the law that was attempting to make us like those states has been at least momentarily struck down.
And at no point so far has this law been in effect, right?
Right. It was immediately stayed.
And the judge in this instance, Judge Conley, it sounds like from what you said, he agreed with the challenge that Planned Parenthood and other critics were bringing here.
Right. That language that I was quoting earlier made pretty clear that he was not convinced there was any medical reason, which was the main argument of the law, is that it will protect a woman who gets an abortion and when there are complications, that she can have the doctor who performed the abortion go with her into the hospital or at least have a relationship with that hospital. But the ACLU and Planned Parenthood presented arguments that convinced Judge Conley anyway that that risk was really not there.
I know it can be dangerous waters to try to guess how another court will rule, but as you said, the state sounds like they're on the road to an appeal here, the Attorney General.
Right.
Any indication from past experience what the Seventh Circuit, you said, might do on an issue?
Right. Well,
like
the Seventh Circuit hasn't addressed one of these laws before, so it and because they sort of agreed with the stay, it seems possible that it would either be a close decision or they might agree with Judge Conley. There are other, like I said, in these other cases where it's being challenged in, I believe it's in Texas and Alabama. Here I have it. My little cheat sheet here. Okay.
Oh, well, that's fancy.
Laws.
It's a good cheat sheet. You can't see this at home.
Laws have been like this, have been struck down already in Alabama and now in Wisconsin. They've been upheld in Texas and Mississippi, and there is a similar law that's going to trial in Louisiana now. So because we've had this split where we got Alabama and Wisconsin struck down, Texas and Mississippi upheld, it's possible this will make it to the Supreme Court.
I was going to say, the things you're saying now make it sound like someday, maybe not this year, maybe not next year, it's going to end up at the Supreme Court of the United States.
Yeah, and maybe Wisconsin's law will be the one, and maybe not. We'll see.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there for now, but we'll be watching this one along with you. Thanks a lot for joining us, as always, Gilman.
Thank you.
That's WPR reporter Gilman Halstead talking about two new court decisions affecting Wisconsin, one on abortion and one on voter ID.
A recent report from the Washington Post named Wisconsin among a handful of states whose power companies are pushing back against the solar industry. That puts Wisconsin, along with Arizona, at the forefront of the fault line between utility companies and rooftop solar.
Mike Ivey joins us now. He's a business reporter for the Capital Times. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, guys.
So what did this recent report say about this solar energy, residential solar energy versus the utility company kerfluffle here in Wisconsin?
Well, the as a reporter for the Washington Post had wrote a story about some of the pushback from the utility industry against rooftop solar, and it was based on a conference that a lot of utility executives had attended. He got a hold of some inside information that wasn't really shared publicly, and it talked about how traditional electric utilities are going to have to really circle the wagons, so to speak, to fend off what they see as a threat from residential solar panels. Obviously, if someone has a solar panel on the top of their house, you can't charge them for that electricity. So there have been a series of rate changes now in Wisconsin. People may start noticing on their electric bill that their monthly fixed charge, that's the amount that is your charge just for being hooked up to the service, is doubled in a lot of places. I know here in Madison, MG&E's monthly service fee has gone from $10 to $19. Similar increases in Milwaukee for customers of We Energies, and also in Green Bay area for public service customers. It's kind of part of a national debate that's really going on now, because the issue is that people are actually using a little less electricity than they used to. Things are more efficient. It's just like with automobiles, but appliances have become more efficient. People are using electricity. The problem for the power companies is their cost to keep the poles and wires operating and the big power plants running hasn't gone down. If anything, it's increased. So they're faced with declining sales at the same time they've got these fixed costs they need to cover. So the approach in Wisconsin now is, let's raise everybody's fixed cost to, in the way the utilities say it, is to spread those costs across all customers. Wisconsin has been probably one of the most aggressive in terms of changing these fixed rates, and I think that's what's kind of caught the attention of the Washington Post and several other outlets. I've seen Wisconsin mentioned with Arizona and New Mexico, two states where, frankly, they probably have more solar installations than they do here, keep getting mentioned in the same in some of the same reports. But Wisconsin is you know, for the solar industry, it's not great publicity here, I guess.
And you've been following this story on and off for the last couple of years, Mike. Have these changes put a damper on the growth of residential solar here in the state?
Well, it's hard to really say. I mean, the industry would say yes. But the real issue is the amount of money that the power company will pay back to customers. If you think back when the home solar energy really started, people would say, I'm generating so much electricity that I can sell it back into the grid, into that connection of poles and wires, the electric grid, and then utilities would actually pay you a little bit for that generation. What they're doing now is they're trying to change some of those payback structures. So that's what happened with We Energies. There's a appeal of a Public Service Commission decision on that now. What it really means is that if you do have the rooftop solar on your house, it may take longer to recover the cost. The payback may be take longer if you're not getting any money back. What's really sort of interesting is that there's not that much rooftop solar in Wisconsin. I was sort of surprised to look at one story for We Energies, the largest utility in the state. There's only 450 We Energy customers that actually have rooftop solar that they're selling back. That's like 0.4% of their customers. MG&E, just a handful of customers, 0.14%. So I've heard some advocates say they're swatting a fly with a nuclear weapon, that we've just got, here's the number, 6 out of every 10,000 utility customers in Wisconsin have some sort of rooftop solar.
So why is Wisconsin in the lead on this, given that as states go, we're not seeing these solar panels blooming on rooftops around the state?
Well, some of the advocates say that, with kind of the shift in state politics here, that the utility industry sort of sees a regulatory agency that may be more favorable to hearing their side of the story. All three commissioners now of the Wisconsin Public Service Commission, this is the quasi-judicial group that sets utility rates, are all Walker appointees, and they've generally gone along with the utility side on a lot of these cases. I mean, I don't think it's any secret that the Walker administration hasn't been a big booster of renewable or alternative energy projects. You can look through a lot of the budget things, and a lot of the support for alternative energy has really been cut. One of the first things that happened in the 2011 budget was to change those focus on energy grants that used to go out to people. So, I mean, they tend to side more with the fossil fuel industry, and you know, that's sort of, I think industry sees that, hey, if we can get things done in Wisconsin, maybe this is an opportunity to set precedent for other states.
As you mentioned in your piece and in that Washington Post report, Wisconsin is one of many states that have introduced or considered legislation changing the way people pay for their electricity, the way the fees work.
Right.
Some critics are saying, hey, this is coming from the conservative group ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. Do Wisconsin's utility rate changes have a connection to model legislation that group has proposed?
Well, I don't think it's word for word the same, but you can look at some of the ALEC proposals, and it talks a lot about one thing that I think has bugged ALEC and or has bugged conservatives are the mandates that you need to get a certain amount of your power from renewable source. And their argument is, let's let the market determine that. We shouldn't be artificially inflating the market by providing subsidies for wind and solar versus coal and gas. Now, the other side of that argument is the coal and gas industry has been getting lots of subsidies for a long time. So it's one of these big kind of policy fights around energy, and it's like trying to turn an aircraft carrier. It's hard to, once it's going in one direction, it's hard to get it to turn. So I think anybody that thought that the fossil fuel industry was going to go quietly away while we all started using electricity and driving more efficient cars and pushing for that was probably mistaken.
We're talking Wisconsin utilities, solar power, and the politics of energy with business reporter Mike Ivey. Mike, how has the solar industry itself responded to all of this? Are they trying to match the influence of utility companies?
Oh, certainly. I mean, they're in there lobbying as well, and they've got their friends in the legislature. It's kind of unfortunate, I think, that a lot of these things tend to break down so much along party lines these days, rather than saying, "Oh, what's really best for the environment and ratepayers and business in general." I think what's a little frustrating to some of the advocates is that Wisconsin did have sort of a burgeoning wind and solar industry going here back in the 2000s, I think even farther back. I remember back in the 90s going up a wind tower with some guys from MG&E, and then they were, making a demonstration product, a project. You saw a lot of wind installations going into Wisconsin, but we've now fallen way behind all the other Midwestern states in terms of wind energy and I think solar as well. So, I mean, those have been policy changes that have gone through the legislature and through the Public Service Commission.
Now, you mentioned the utilities case here a few moments ago. They say, hey, we've got fixed costs, even if some people are at least in part opting out. We've got to supply power to everyone else. And they've said there's a sort of a justice thing here that if I install solar power and I'm more efficient, I'm paying less, so the costs end up falling on my neighbors who haven't done those things.
Yeah, right on. I mean, I think it's not a black and white issue for sure, because and there, on days where the sun's not shining or you don't have the wind isn't blowing, you still want to be connected to the grid so you can grab that power as you need it. I think what's happened is it's come on pretty quickly, and the size of the increases have been pretty large. I saw someone had quoted Phil Montgomery, who's a member of the State Public Service Commission. He's a smart guy. He's been in the legislature, and he said the only thing slowing down a faster increase is that we didn't want to, raise it too quickly. There was this is actually something that I found quite interesting. Madison Gas and Electric, in its own analysis, had said if we really want to get homeowners to pick up their share of the fixed cost, the monthly electric fee should be about $70 a month. So, I mean, there's a lot of customers who their entire bill isn't $70 a month. And then when the fixed rates are that high, then you lose the incentive to use less power yourself at home, because what they've done to offset that increase in the fixed cost is they said, well, we can increase your fixed cost, but we'll lower the kilowatt hour charge, or we'll lower the rate that you pay for natural gas. Well, that acts as an incentive to use more rather than an incentive to conserve.
You know, Mike, as we wrap up, big picture, we've seen the cell phone industry industry shaking up the old telecommunications. We've seen the internet shaking up everything, media, retail. Is this the next step, new energy technologies leading to what's going to be a restructuring in the energy industry?
Probably maybe in our lifetimes, Rob, I don't know. But like I said, it's like trying to move an aircraft carrier, because just think of the investment in all those poles and wires and giant power plants that you see, the power station that they built in Oak Creek in Milwaukee. That was the largest public utility project in state history, over $2 billion. I mean, that's four times the cost of doing a highway interchange somewhere. Big money here we're talking, and a lot of people are invested in those utilities as well, even people with their, you know, the seniors with their retirement accounts. They don't want to see the utility companies go out of business either, so I don't think there's a real simple answer to it.
Mike, thanks as always for joining us.
You bet, guys. Thank you.
That's Mike Ivey. He covers business at the Capital Times.
Coming up next, we'll find out about the causes and coping strategies for compassion fatigue. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Remember to check out Central Time over at the Central Time Facebook page. And you can always tweet us on any topic we're talking about, or not talking about for that matter, at our Twitter feed. That's at Central Time WPR. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Millions of people in the United States provide care for someone who's ill, disabled, or too elderly to care for themselves. In 2012, almost 30% of the U.S. population could be counted on as an informal caregiver. Many times, caregivers are family members, sons or daughters, or siblings.
After months of caregiving, one problem that could cause a lot of personal, emotional, and physical distress is compassion fatigue. That's a term that refers to a breakdown of empathy. It can lead to physical pain, maybe even irresponsible decision-making.
Patricia Smith joins us now. She's the founder of the Compassion Fatigue Awareness Project and Healthy Caregiving LLC. Patricia, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here today.
Well, first off, how do you define compassion fatigue?
Well, compassion fatigue is something that I believe a lot of people just think you're tired of giving. And oftentimes you'll go to your physician, or you'll go to even a mental health worker, and they'll say, you know, take a week off and go to Hawaii. Well, that's a misnomer. That's just not what it is. Dr. Charles Figley, who's a professor at Tulane Traumatology Institute, coined the phrase back in 1995, and these are his exact words. Compassion fatigue is a state experienced by those helping people in distress. It is an extreme state of tension and preoccupation with the suffering of those being helped to the degree that it can create a secondary traumatic stress for the helper. So it's actually a secondary traumatic stress. It's not just that you're tired. You are actually being stressed emotionally, physically, psychologically by the work you're doing.
So a lot of people might think that they are tired, that vacation to Hawaii is going to help fix the problem. So what are some of the common symptoms of compassion fatigue so that people can start to recognize it in themselves?
Okay. Some of the symptoms are isolation. It's all just too much, so you tend to isolate yourself. You go, you know, in the workplace, perhaps if you're a manager, a director, you go in your office and you shut the door, which, of course, is the worst thing possible. You need to be available for your people. Emotional outbursts, and that comes from years and years of just pushing down emotions, you know, just pushing it down and pushing it down. I can handle this. I can do it. I can make it happen. I can do better. I can do more. So one day it just all comes out with a vengeance. Another one is sadness and apathy. You just have this veil of sadness over you all the time. Impulse to rescue anyone in need. We see this a lot with animal caregivers who suffer from very high levels of compassion fatigue because of the work they do every day. You see persistent physical ailments that never go away. You know, it's the person with the headache, the sinus infection that never clears up, the sore throat, the backache, the gastrointestinal. You know, the thing that's just always there, and you go to the doctor and say, I've got this going on, and it's very real to you as the compassion fatigue sufferer, but there's no cause that the doctor can really find because it's all something that's psychological, and the body finally calls out and says stop, and that's how it does it with physical pain. Substance abuse, and that would be self-medicating with alcohol, tobacco, pornography, particularly with, you know, computers. It's a way of self-medicating to get away from things, and it's an unhealthy way to get away from it. There are many healthy ways you can help yourself. Hypervigilance, hyperarousal, you know, someone shuts a door, slams a door, and you jump 3 feet off your off your chair. And then one of the ones that really tells you that you probably need some help from a mental health professional is recurring nightmares or flashbacks of incidences that you've experienced.
And what about any change in attitude toward the person who's being cared for? Is that something that we see in terms of what we might typically think of as compassion fatigue?
Of course. And that's because they become the object of your anger, of your frustration, of your stress. And that's where I think a lot of the elder abuse comes in. You know, people, elderly people in assisted living or dementia or memory facilities, you know, don't have all of their faculties to work with. And it's very easy to become very agitated working with someone who you have to repeat it 5 or 6 times, or they can't hear, or they don't understand what you're saying. So, you know, an emotional outburst could come in the way of, you know, maybe doing something that would be considered elder abuse. Or working with children as well. You know, child advocates can suffer from this. Social workers, anyone who works with someone. Law enforcement, which I think maybe we're seeing now some of that. I think there's a lot of very high levels of compassion fatigue in our law enforcement system. And it's coming out where they're fearful and they maybe move too quickly, you know, to make a decision that doesn't take, you know, the time to really look at it and make a really good, solid decision.
Do we know when compassion fatigue is most likely to set in?
It can be any time. It's cumulative. And, you know, one of the causes is a history of unresolved childhood trauma. You have things happen as a child and you don't ever put it to rest, and so it just grows and grows and grows. So someone who may be, you know, newly out of college and a social worker, and she's just so excited about doing what she's gonna, you know, always wanted to do, and within a month the symptoms could surface, or she could go for years and continue to be able to stuff it down, but at some point it will definitely surface.
I read recently in an article about compassion fatigue that 3 months is about the window that most families can handle caregiving or a crisis that requires caregiving. And sometimes these days, you know, caregiving can be a marathon. It can last not 3 months, but it can last 3 years, 4 years, five years.
Yeah.
Is that
yeah.
part of the issue here?
Well, of course. And it's a roller coaster ride, and I can attest to that because I'm helping care for my 94-year-old mother, and it's gone on for over a year. And luckily, I have great family support. You know, a sister that we work together, and a brother who does all the financial. And I mean, we've got it worked out really well. But some don't have that. You know, some are the only sibling and have to deal with this. And the thing is, it changes constantly. And if you're not really good about change, and you don't adapt quickly, and you're very very flexible, the levels of stress can just skyrocket, and that's because it goes on, and you have to deal, well, you have to navigate the health system, basically, and that's not an easy thing to do these days.
We're talking right now with Patricia Smith, the founder of the Compassion Fatigue Awareness Project, about what compassion fatigue is and what we can do about it. And Patricia, you're out there trying to draw awareness to this. Can you tell us a story about someone you've worked with that sort of gets at the big picture of what it's like to experience compassion fatigue?
People I work with when I do my presentations, and I mean, for the last 15 years, I've been doing this work, and I've worked with law enforcement officials, chaplains, psychologists, mental health workers, healthcare workers, social workers, animal welfare. I mean, it is across what I call across the curriculum. It's happening everywhere, and it's very intense with family caregivers because you've got that additional emotional tie to the person, and there might be unresolved issues that were brought into the caregiving arena, and oftentimes you see that. There's all kinds of stories. I mean, you know, from every single, you know, area of caregiving. The animal welfare workers are very interesting in what often happens with them because they want to rescue, and they're very idealistic. You know, they want to rescue every animal. You'll get someone who, you know, she'll raise her hand in a presentation, and she'll say, you know, I have 4 dogs and 3 cats and a couple of guinea pigs and a garter snake, and it's taking all of, you know, my money every month, and I live in a 1-bedroom apartment, and I don't know what to do. They kind of work themselves into a hole, and then they go down, they spiral down, down, down. And if they don't do something, it can really, really devastate your life as a caregiver. You have to have very strong personal boundaries to be a healthy caregiver.
So how do you begin to come back from this, assuming that you put all the puzzle pieces together and you say, hey, it looks like I might be someone who's suffering from compassion fatigue? What are some of the steps you could take to heal it?
Well, the main thing for individuals is to practice what I call authentic, sustainable self-care daily. Like I said, the trip to Hawaii is a wonderful thing. It'll fill you up and you'll come back, you know, invigorated. But if you don't continue to take care of yourself, you'll spiral back down. So authentic means self-care that's authentic to you. You know, a friend says, I run every day and I feel great. And I think if you do that, you'll feel great too. And you run to the end of the block and you realize you absolutely hate it because it's not authentic to you. And, you know, we're in a society where Madison Avenue is telling us what to wear, how to look, what car to drive, what job to have, what school to go to. You have to find out what's authentic to you. And it has to be something sustainable that you continue to do year after year so you can continue doing the work that you want to do. And of course, the other thing is you practice standards of self-care, which is good nutrition, good rest, healthy relationships. You know, try to get away from dysfunctional relationships. They take all of your energy. You want to practice standards that show that self-care will bring you to wellness. You need to integrate time for yourself, work, and your relationships, which isn't easy. Latest study shows that the two main things to remain a healthy caregiver is to build a healthy support system and to find some sort of spirituality. And they're not talking about a religion, an organized religion. And indeed, if that works for you, that's fine. But what they're talking about is some sort of spirituality where there's an interconnectedness. For me, it's being around animals, being where there's water, walking in nature. That's how I build myself up, because healthy caregiving is build up, empty out, build up, empty out. And that has to go on continually all day long, because that's what goes on in the workplace or with your family caregiving. So you need to do those things.
We're talking right now about what to do when you're experiencing compassion fatigue as a caregiver. Maybe you're caring for a family member or a friend. Well, Patricia Smith is with us now. She's the founder of the Compassion Fatigue Awareness Project.
And you can join in. Are we telling your story here? Do you provide care from someone, either someone in your family or as part of your job? Have you ever experienced what our guest is talking about, something that felt like this kind of compassion fatigue, or seen it in someone else? How do you deal with it? How do you move beyond it? How do you heal from it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about compassion fatigue now, and what to do when it's something that you're experiencing, how to deal with it, recognize it, and how to hopefully come back from it and replenish yourself. We're talking with Patricia Smith, the founder of the Compassion Fatigue Awareness Project.
And we want to hear from you, your questions, and maybe your experiences. If you're providing care for someone in your family, or you do this as a volunteer, or as your job, have you experienced compassion fatigue? How do you deal with it? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. Sherry joins us first from Green Bay. Hi, Sherry.
Hello.
What did you want to share?
Yeah, I was just listening to the show, and I thought it was very interesting. I'm a foster parent, and it seems like when I hit that three-month mark after a child arrives, I go through time at foster fatigue, and I try to make sure that that I can build a strong support network, and I've got somebody that can help me try to get past that three-month bump with each of the kids that I've had.
So
that's excellent.
You've experienced
a solid support
months.
System is the best thing you can do.
And Sherry, did it take you a while to figure that out and to figure out how to replenish yourself?
It did, actually. I'm on my third foster child, and I found it interesting that for each one of them, it was kind of that three-month mark, and I just have to keep trying to find other people. And I really wish that would have been part of the training when we went through foster parent training, because it's just interesting that is what I've experienced.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Sherry, and I appreciate the work that you're doing, too, with your family. And Patricia, what about that, the support network? How do you build it when you're in the middle of the challenge of the caregiving? How do you take the time to reach out to people and hopefully accept them reaching out to you?
Well, that's one of the things that's difficult, is because usually people who are at risk for compassion fatigue are doers. You know, we have a very, very hard time saying no. We say yes to everything, and oftentimes we're very frazzled because we're trying to manage everything around us, and you have to simply take the time to figure it out. and you want to find someone who is what Dr. Judith Orloff calls, you don't want an emotional vampire. And they have a way of attaching to people that are caring and giving and empathetic and have compassion. And what they will do is that they will dump everything on you, and they'll walk away full, and you're totally depleted because you've once again listened to stories that might be traumatizing. So what you want to do is try to figure out, you know, who in your life fills you up? Who do you laugh with? Who do you have a good time with? Who do you, you know, go have a cup of coffee with, and you just talk and fill each other up? When you walk away, you feel really good about yourself, and you can't wait until you see that person, you know, again. You've got to be able to identify those people. And the thing that I found out that was very interesting when I worked in animal welfare work, I was so idealistic. I'd been in college textbook publishing for many, many years and wrote for the San Jose Mercury News because my background is actually journalism. And I wanted to do something different, and I wanted to care for animals. Well, little did I know that the underbelly of animal caregiving is very, very difficult. And I wanted to share it with my family, and my family were all very, very close. They didn't want to hear the stories of hoarding and abuse. And, you know, I'd go home and nobody wanted to hear my stories. And at first it was very hurtful because I thought, you know, they've always been there for me. I've always been there for them. But then once I understood what was going on and I learned more and more about compassion fatigue, which is where I first learned about it in animal welfare work, I realized that it wasn't fair to them. My stories were traumatizing them, and they were re-traumatizing me. So basically colleagues, you know, because they're experiencing the same thing. As long as you build each other up and you don't keep going to that place of trauma. And the other thing I wanted to mention, volunteers, because in the break they mentioned, you know, if you volunteer, volunteers will often bring, they're already compassion fatigued, and they will bring it to the environment. And so having educational workshops for volunteers as part of their training is an excellent idea. So they're aware of it and they don't contribute to it, because it can really create a very dysfunctional organization when the staff are suffering from compassion fatigue and then the volunteers bring it in from the outside.
Let's go back to our callers then. We've got Boris joining us next in Madison. Hi, Boris.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I called in because it was this rather serendipitous moment I just experienced. I got into my car from a care center parking lot to drive home after taking care of my grandmother, who recently suffered a major stroke. And I turned on the radio, and here was this show that I almost couldn't believe it, right? Because it's something that I'm now beginning to internalize and understand and experience personally.
That's an amazing story, Boris. Oh, my goodness, I've got goosebumps. Yeah. That happens so often. I'm so glad you've tuned in because, you know, to know about this before you get too involved with the caregiving, which you will, of course you will. It's your grandmother, you love her, you want to care for her, but you need to care for yourself first so you have something to give her.
And any advice for Boris as he just starts out on this journey?
Get help. Either, you know, if you have other siblings or you have neighbors or relatives who are willing to help, and set up schedules. You know, go on an Excel sheet and set up schedules. Make sure you schedule time for yourself, things that fill you up. Then you have stories to bring to your grandmother, you know, to share with her, and it makes a much more fulfilling relationship as her health declines. Take good care of yourself, get rest, eat well, exercise, all of the things we hear all the time, but you have to do it. You absolutely have to remain healthy.
Well, thank you so much, and I wish you well with your grandmother.
Oh, me too, Boris.
Appreciate
good luck.
That. Let's try to get one more quick call in. Katie joins us next in Hayward. Katie, hi.
Hi. Well, I kind of have a different type of perspective in terms of caregiving. I'm a teacher. I've been teaching for about 7 years now, and one of the things that I'm finding as caregiver fatigue is that I expend a lot of my caregiving energy throughout the day and my place of employment, and then when I get home, it winds up being sapped of that energy for my own children at home. Some of the remedies I was given and advice I was given really, really early on when I was working in early childhood care was that it was really important to try not to be in a classroom where the kids were the same age as my own children. Because when you get back home, then at least it's a different type of energy you need to, like, spend. So when I had babies, it was really advised, like, try not to be in the baby room. Try if you can to be in the 3-year-old room or something, so that when you get home, you can really appreciate spending time with your kids.
Interesting, Katie. Thank you for that. And Patricia, compassion fatigue for teachers. How do you handle giving to kids during the day and then your own children at night?
Right. And you're very astute to have made that correlation. That's just, I just had an aha moment when you were talking. Teachers are definitely suffering from high levels of compassion fatigue, particularly in our high schools where so many things are happening. One of the things that I know social workers particularly, and I love working with young social workers because they're so idealistic and they just want to do so well, you know, with their people. One told me a story once, and she said, you know, she had the same issue. She does her work all day, and then at night she drives in, and her husband's car there, so she knows inside the house is her husband and her 3 little children, and somehow she has to make that transition. So even though she's feeling rather depleted, she has to fill up somehow in order to go in there and be there and be present and mindful for her family.
And in our last 30 seconds, what would you advise?
Well, what she does is she drives in, she gets out of her car, she goes over to the side of the house where there's a garbage can, she lifts the garbage lid, and she psychologically dumps the day in the garbage can. She puts the lid on, and she goes in, and she's there for her family. It's a letting go ritual, and I highly recommend that to anyone who has to transition throughout the day.
Well,
Patricia, and it works.
Patricia, lots of wonderful advice there. We appreciate that. And thank you so much for joining us today and sharing with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Patricia Smith. She's the founder of the Compassion Fatigue Awareness Project and Healthy Caregiving LLC. And you can read more about this over on the Central Time Facebook page and also leave a comment of your own there as well. Last Friday, we talked about the idea of mandatory voting after President Obama mentioned it in a question and answer session. Tried to find out what you thought, too.
Yeah, our guest, political scientist Ken Mayer, said the idea of making voting compulsory is really, really unlikely to happen here in the United States. But it is quite a conversation starter. A lot of you weighed in on the idea over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Jackie writes, yes, everyone should vote, but where is the freedom in mandating that they do vote?
We heard from Don, who wrote, make none of the above an option, results binding if none of the above wins. And Don says, I'll think about it.
Carol tells us, can you imagine America where everyone voted? It would be an America that actually represents us all. This is in our hands, and it can't be taken away unless we give it away.
And Donna wrote, sounds good, but I think it's a bad idea. How about just making Election Day a national holiday? Also, Donna says, how about some free bus rides or more frequent time schedules for buses on Election Day?
You can check out more of that conversation and weigh in with your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page.